Never again without my permission. I should like this expressly understood. I'd never been the sort of woman to issue commands, not even with my children. And Church looked as taken aback as an Englishman would ever allow himself to be. Now, Eliza, please be reasonable.
I'm being perfectly reasonable.
Alexander's last will says that his things are to be disposed of at such time and in such manner as his survivor sees fit. And I am the survivor and heir.
No one disputes that,
Church replied with a long-suffering sigh.
Then please tell Mr. Pendleton that I must have an inventory of every scrap of paper that was taken. Every scrap.
If you insist, Church said.
I do. With that, I sat in the leather chair, put my trembling hands atop the desk, and took a moment to compose myself. My sister pulled up a seat beside me and slipped her hand into mine.
It's only that such things must be broached softly with Mr. Pendleton. He is a man it wouldn't do to alienate at this moment. I knew she was right, not because Pendleton was an executor, but because he was our only friendly witness to the duel. The only man who could establish that my husband was murdered in cold blood. Because Burr's witness, William Van Ness, was telling a different story. That Alexander had fiddled with his glasses, sighted the pistol, and fired first at Burr, not in the air as he truly had. I hated hearing these details, dreaming of them, fearing that our children would hear them one day too. But they were important to know and to refute, in order to protect my husband's reputation.
Then please broach it softly with him. In the meantime, I'll take Hamilton's papers with me to the Grange.
Church scowled.
Surely you realize you cannot return to the Grange.
I realized no such thing. Why not?
You have limited means without Hamilton's income. It's impossible for you to be at the Grange without horses, which you can ill afford. Besides, their expense would pay for your house rent here in town. In fact, the Grange might be let.
I blinked. Having never considered the possibility of renting the house, my husband had been so proud to build for us. Imagining strangers there was too much on top of everything else. But now I realized that the decision wasn't mine. It was yet another thing the executors might decide for me. Women had never been granted the right to vote in New York. We couldn't hold office and were barred from certain occupations. Our ability to manage property and legal matters was circumscribed. So I should have expected that my fate might be entrusted to my brother-in-law. Certainly, John Barker Church had always been indulgent with Angelica. She was as free as any woman I knew under laws that still made a husband his wife's master. But I hadn't married him, and chafed at the idea Alexander should have left me even remotely under his power. Church, the man whose accursed pistols had killed both my son and my husband. My sister must have sensed my fury and resentment, because she gave her husband a sharp glance.
"We didn't think you'd wish to take the boys out of school in the city, Eliza. You can, of course, leave them with us if you prefer to live at the Grange."
It was a generous offer. But Alexander and I had determined that our children should never be without at least one parent's care. And did I not owe it to the memory of my beloved husband to keep his children together? Church cleared his throat.
"You might as well know, Hamilton painted a rather more rosy picture of the value of his assets than warranted."
I flinched, half in disbelief. "My husband was the architect of this nation's economy. You cannot expect me to believe he was careful with the nation's money, but not his own," Angelica replied, and given her expression, I realized that my sister wished to tell me this even less than I wanted to hear it. "I don't understand," I said, wanting to see the proof for myself. Church cleared his throat again.
"I estimate the debt to be somewhere in the nature of $50,000.
It was so staggering a sum,
I lost all power of speech. Even if Hamilton had lived, it would have taken years of hard work and frugality to ever repay it.
You needn't be frightened, Church quickly added, affecting a smile that attempted reassurance and warmth. Your father and I will see to your day-to-day needs, of course, and if need be, the Grange can eventually be sold.
Now it felt as if the world fell out beneath me completely. A cry of anguish escaped me before Church hastened to say,
But you won't lose it. After the auction, you'll be able to buy the Grange back at half its price.
I took in a ragged breath, torn between gratitude and confusion about the house. You're suggesting some financial trick. Perhaps something that might lose me every last penny.
It's a political trick, my sister explained. It seems there are people for whom your husband's indebtedness is more embarrassing than it could ever be for you.
It took me a moment to guess her meaning. Then I understood. Federalists. It would hurt the party at the ballot box if it were to be publicly known that Alexander Hamilton, their founder, the man of American financial wizardry, had died in debt. We'd already lost one presidential election to Thomas Jefferson. The party couldn't risk losing another. So the Federalists would pay a great deal to keep Alexander Hamilton's children from being turned out of house and home. And I found that more reassuring than I ought to have.
They intend to make me a loan.
A gift, actually, Church explained.
A number of prominent men will establish a trust fund on condition of secrecy. It is to be kept even from the children.
I didn't like secrets. I'd been hurt by secrets. But I had no interest whatsoever in giving the public another excuse to dishonor my husband's memory. So Alexander's indebtedness was a secret I could easily keep. My uneasiness came in the realization of how dependent I was now upon the mercies of others. My brother-in-law, the executors, the Federalists, and even my sons.
You look dashing, I said, helping my 18-year-old Alex tie his cravat and turn up the corners of his starched white collar. Your father would be so proud of you today.
Alex forced a smile past the grief for his father that cast its shadow over this occasion.
Dashing, but not a dandy, he asked, buttoning his neatly tailored blue coat, but eyeing the plainer black one hanging on his wardrobe.
No, my sweet boy, not a dandy.
Like me, Alex was born unburdened with the expectations of an eldest, but never pampered like the youngest. Whereas our Philip had been darkly handsome and rakish, young Alex was fair and freckled and gallant. And because he didn't have his father here to take pride in him on this day, I must lavish praise upon him for the both of us.
To think, Alexander Hamilton's namesake is graduating from Columbia College.
Despite all your father's many accomplishments, even he didn't do that.
Only because of the revolution, Alex replied, then took a deep breath,
as if he needed to steel himself against the world as bravely as his father had done before him.
And he was given an honorary degree later, wasn't he?
I smiled softly, realizing how aware Alex was of the shoes he'd have to fill. He was now responsible for the support and care of 6 siblings and a broken-hearted mother. His father's will had bade him to consider it his responsibility. Worse, I now had the unhappy duty of adding to his burdens.
Alex, I cannot allow you to go to Boston to take a position in the counting house as we'd planned.
My son blanched.
But I've already agreed. Uncle Church and Mr. Pendleton say that I cannot now decline.
I know, I replied, trying not to show how it vexed me that gentlemen all seemed to view me as an enfeebled creature, too broken by grief to know what was best for my own children.
But my wish is for you to stay in New York.
Alex furrowed his ginger brow.
You worry, I'll fritter away my evenings.
A faint note of hurt underscored his words, as if he thought himself accused of gambling, drinking, or carousing,
or that I might neglect church and not know right from wrong.
No, I reassured him. You're a good boy. But Philip had been a good boy, too. I wasn't worried about the evil that my son might get himself into in Boston. I worried about the evil lying in wait for a son of Alexander Hamilton, especially one who shared his name. Every day Alex was out of my sight, I'd live in fear of him being lured into a duel or simply murdered somewhere far from his relations or anyone who could help him. Perhaps he, too, would be found floating face down in a river like James Callender. Of course, I could say none of this to my son without provoking some show of Hamiltonian bravado. So I only said, I'm a sorrowing mother overwhelmed with the responsibility of caring for all your brothers and sisters. I can't manage without you. It wasn't fair what I was asking him. A young man on the cusp of making his own future. Hadn't we fought to ensure that young men like Alex could choose for themselves how and where they lived, worked, and made a name? And yet he swallowed down his objections, even if with trepidation.
Am I to farm at the Grange?
I smiled softly, knowing that none of Hamilton's bookish boys were suited to working the soil. Nor were there resources at the Grange that might make us a profit. We'll take a house in the city so you can study the law, I said. A house big enough for all your brothers and sisters, and for Anna to have her privacy, and large enough to store all your father's papers, perhaps with a library that a writer might visit.
Alex squinted. A writer?
I want to hire a biographer, I explained. They'd murdered my husband. They'd taken him from me. But I still had his words, and they were my solace. Hamilton could still speak to me through those pages. His love letters, his ideas, his essays. Thousands of pages. They could kill him, but they couldn't silence him. Not if his story was told. Not if his work was preserved. And I resolved to collect the pieces of the legacy Alexander left behind. For just as Captain Molly had taken her fallen husband's place at his cannon, I would take my husband's place fighting for his country. And this, Alexander's life, his death, and everything he stood for, had now become my battle. Chapter 37.
I pray God that something may remain for the maintenance of my dear wife and children. But should it be on the contrary, probably her own patrimonial resources will preserve her from indigence.
Alexander Hamilton in his last will. August, 1804, Albany. Let me take you home, Angelica had urged when New York indicted Burr for murder. Papa has been frantic to embrace and comfort you. He's too old and sick to leave the house now, but I fear he'll attempt it anyway if you don't fly to his arms. And it may kill him. I'd won the first battle in my war against Burr, so I went. Because I was a dutiful daughter. Because I needed my father as much as he needed me. And because my sister convinced me it might do Anna some good. Together, the three of us arrived at the pastures, and my heart beat faster. And only belatedly did I realize why. Alexander and I married in this house. Philip had been born here. We'd started our life and our family here. And perhaps some part of me hoped to be reunited with him here too. I longed to hear his laugh float down from the upstairs salon where he'd studied for the law and planned our future. But of course now our dreams and plans were nothing more than the dust that had collected on every surface. Prince would never have allowed the dust in his day, I thought, running a finger over the sideboard beneath Mama's portrait, who would have thrown a fit to find dirt in her house. Prince had died the previous summer and been buried on the plot of Schuyler Land where slaves were laid to rest, next to Jenny and Dinah, who had perished without having experienced the freedom she had once tried to seize for herself. Jenny, Dinah, Prince, Mama, Peggy, Philip, Alexander. All ghosts, and the house was like a tomb. A lonely clock ticked in the deserted blue parlor. A faded green velvet chair propped open the door to Papa's vacant study, a study we'd once made available to Aaron Burr. And it made me remember that, right from the first moment, Burr had wanted something from my family. He'd borrowed my father's books for his own advancement. In repayment, he'd told me of my husband's victory of Yorktown, and oh, I think he was jealous even then. Burr was always clever. But what did he accomplish? He never penned any great treatises, never signed his name to our founding documents, never wrote a book that I knew of. Even the bank he created was birthed of trickery. He was never more than a crooked gun. But Jefferson had aimed him against us, and he struck true. Bitterly I climbed the stairs as the memories washed over me, my fingers tracing the hatchet mark in the banister. Then I found myself standing outside the room where Alexander and I first made love. Empty study, empty parlor, empty bed. It took me a moment to compose myself. Then I knocked upon my father's bedroom door, where he was confined by his illness.
"Is that you, my pretty pet?" Papa called.
My youngest sister, Katie, was the pet, which had not stopped her from running off, in what was now fine Schuyler tradition, to marry her forbidden beau, so I replied, "No, Papa, it's your obedient daughter." At the sight of me, my father's eyes teared over, and then so did mine. He reached out his hands, and I went to him, where his badly damaged legs, cut and drained of gouty matter, were propped upon pillows. Age had rendered my father smaller than I remembered. He'd let himself grow frail, stubbornly resisting the doctor's orders and taking little in the way of food. Fortunately, as we exchanged greetings, it was clear his heart was unchanged.
"I don't know, my dearly beloved child, in what condition Hamilton left you as to pecuniary resources, but I still have the power, attention, and determination to render you and my dear grandchildren perfectly comfortable."
I kissed him tearfully. "Thank you, Papa." He pressed the point.
"My fixed determination is to pass the rest of the days my Creator has allotted me in promoting your happiness. So name a wish to me."
Perhaps he thought I'd ask for money or land. But I knew my wish. "I must have Alexander's letters."
Papa nodded. "When your mother passed, I found comfort in her letters. But I promised her that I'd burn them to preserve her privacy, and so I did."
I was glad Alexander had never asked such a thing of me, because I could still hear his voice when I read his letters. Every word was both a balm and a wound that bled anew. But that wasn't why I wanted them. When I explained myself, Papa's puzzled expression melted to concern.
"Eliza, remember that we owe duties to the living and a humble resignation to the divine. A mind so pious as yours, so deeply impressed with the duties of a mother, will feel the force of my remarks."
I did feel the force of his remarks. But I was in no way resigned. It couldn't be God's will that my husband's life and his life work came to nothing. I wouldn't let it. And so, the rest of that summer, while Vice President Burr fled from city to city like the villain he was, I tended to my father, who had to be carried to the dining table in the morning and back up to bed at night. Then each evening, I sat in his study, sorting through sheaves of papers. When the leaves turned, Papa was feeling stronger and able to walk about the house, so it was time to return to Manhattan. Burr had been indicted in New Jersey as well as New York,
each jurisdiction vying for the honor of hanging him. His property had been seized and was to be auctioned, and this I wanted to see with my own eyes. On the day we were to depart, Papa said,
"In your new house, you must render yourself perfectly comfortable, and call on me, my beloved child, without hesitation. I will send you butter and pig's feet sauce and truffles. Whatever you desire."
He'd scarcely finished speaking when my eldest daughter burst into the dining room.
"Philip is gone," Anna cried.
My heart leaped to my throat at seeing her in such distress, tears in her eyes, her hair wild. I folded her into my embrace, wondering if we were to go again through her fresh grief, or if she'd finally come back to herself. Wrapping my arms around her sturdy shoulders, I said,
"My dear child, you know, Philip,"
Anna pushed me violently away.
"You always take his side."
"Anna,"
my father barked. Her grandfather's authority broke through to her, forcing her to hang her head as she wept.
"But Philip promised we'd go swimming before we left on the sloop. Now he's gone ahead of us. He broke his promise, and Papa says a promise must never be broken."
It was all too much. For a moment, I felt myself spiraling down into weariness and despair. How long would my poor daughter live in a state of madness? And would she drag me there with her? Bringing my hands to my face as I considered what to say, my sister swept in with her satchel. "It isn't Philip's fault," Angelica snapped. Since learning of my daughter's troubles, Angelica had made it her business to study every book she could find on derangements of the mind. And there were not many, for in those days they were obscure and could only be had from Europe. She'd never approved of Alexander's notion that we should go along with Anna's delusions, but now she did just that. "It's much too cold to swim, and I told him to get the horses and go ahead of us, so we can get an early start on our day." I nodded gratefully as she insisted my daughter wipe her tears. "If you want to be angry with someone, be angry with me. Now, kiss your grandpapa farewell." My daughter obeyed and let her aunt usher her out. Then, wearily, I stood at the window, staring out at a world in autumn decay.
"Papa, I don't know how to be both mother and father to my orphaned children."
"You will not do it alone," Papa said. "Your sister is devoted to you, and our children will have me too." "Yes, my beloved, I say our children, for may it please the Almighty to let me remain in life. You and they will have my constant love and tenderness."
Deeply touched, I blinked away tears.
"Oh, Papa."
"You must promise to let your family be of aid and comfort to you now, Elizabeth."
I nodded, pressing away the tears with my fingertips.
"And you must promise to do as the doctor bids you."
"I am much recovered," Papa said, rising from the table on his own efforts to prove it. "Indeed, I am not without hopes of being able to visit you in the winter, if there should be sledding."
I planted a kiss upon my father's cheek, by his hairline, right where I used to kiss him when I was a small child returning from the wilds before he would haul me up into his arms. "Well, if you cannot come to us, we'll return for the holiday." But my father didn't live to see another Christmas. January 1805, New York City. "I'm giving you part of my inheritance," Angelica was saying while I pored over bills for meat, flour, and candles, "and I don't want an argument." Papa's death had been a cruel blow for both of us, but for me, one more catastrophe in a parade of them. All my life, I'd taken strength from knowing I might always seek refuge in my father's strong and loving arms, in Philip Schuyler's home, power, name, and wealth. Now my father, my first hero, the first man I ever loved, was gone from this world. And there seemed no refuge for me anywhere, except perhaps in my older sister, upon whose generosity I'd unquestionably presumed too much. She'd already made it her habit to stop by each week with parcels of clothes, food, and other necessities, much as I'd once done for impoverished widows, and I felt humbled. I cannot accept your offer, Angelica. You're entitled to your share of Papa's... What am I going to do with little patches of dirt in the wilderness? She asked. For our father's wealth had been tied up in land that he'd divided amongst all his children, and little else in the end. We knew Papa's wish was to emulate George Washington, who had ordered the emancipation of his slaves upon Martha's death. And so, though my father had not provided for it specifically in his will, we had directed the executors to release Papa's few remaining slaves from bondage. And seeing that finally accomplished was more valuable to me than any inheritance. As I swallowed with bittersweet emotion at the thought, Angelica coughed on the smoky haze of my parlor. The townhouse young Alex had procured for us was a bargain, but every sort of thing was wrong with it, from leaky roof to a neglected chimney flue. Take what I'm offering, my dear Eliza, if only to rent a better house. Besides, I want you to have something you own outright, something Hamilton's creditors can have no claim upon, even if you only sell it off parcel by parcel to pay a biographer. She knew the trouble I'd had in engaging a writer, and not only because of the disapproval of the executors, who didn't seem to realize that no greater investment could be made than in memorializing Hamilton. My husband's name and reputation were the only patrimony he'd left my children, and it would determine their future prospects. Even if a biography hadn't been a mission of love, it was a mission of survival. The work could be sold for a profit if written seriously by a man of letters. But the first writer I tried to engage had, upon one glance at the thousands of pages Alexander left behind, virtually fled, quitting the project before it was begun. You know, the writer said the strangest thing to me. He actually mused out loud that there was more money to be had in refusing to write a biography of Hamilton. It had seemed too odd a thing to mention before. I thought perhaps he meant only that he could find better-paying work. But it nagged at me. Angelica narrowed her eyes. You think someone is trying to thwart you? I should like to think it sounds preposterous, I replied. But having been the wife of a man so often conspired against, how could I dismiss it? It's been half a year since Alexander's death. And what has Jefferson said about it? Nothing. Silence. Which is just what he wants. An eternal silence from Alexander Hamilton. Even knowing all we now knew of Jefferson's duplicitous nature, Angelica didn't seem quite convinced that the President of the United States would stoop to conspire against the widow of his dead nemesis. But she allowed, "There are plenty of others who have cause to worry about what might be revealed in your husband's papers." That much was true. Alexander had tangled with nearly every powerful man in the country. What my overly frank husband might have written about any of them, or what they might have confided to him in a letter, meant that his entire record of correspondence had the potential to ruin political careers. Not that this would stop me. "Then the writer must not only be a man of letters," I began, "but an incorruptible..." A scream cut off my words. In a household of children, I expected a degree of disorder, but what we heard was a shriek of pure terror. And then it went chillingly silent. I bolted from the parlor, Angelica close on my heels. We raced upstairs, cries and pleadings reaching us before we'd made it to the nursery. But inside, I found myself momentarily confused. My 5-year-old Lisbeth sat in a ball on the floor, her head buried in her knees, sobs making her little shoulders heave. Meanwhile, my eldest daughter knelt on a tiny bed, tightly holding a pillow flat to the coverlet. And in trying to make sense of the commotion, I planted my hands on my hips,
What in heaven's name?
A child's desperate, choking gasp stole my words, my breath, what was left of my heart as I realized what was happening. Tiny feet kicked out from under the sprawl of Anna's skirt. A terrifying understanding dawned, and I lunged for her. It was all I could do to wrestle Anna off the bed, off my 3-year-old boy whose raw, desperate gasp for air sounded like sandpaper rasping across a rough plank of wood. I had Anna by the arms, but at 20 years old she was strong and in a state of raving frenzy, screaming and fighting. It was left to my sister to comfort my poor red-faced little Phil. Meanwhile, Anna flailed at me, so strong in her fury it was as if a demon possessed her. I struggled to reason with her, much less defend myself from her blows as she dragged me to the floor.
Anna, please! You'll hurt yourself, my love, please!
Je ne vous connais pas!
Anna spat at me. My sister helped me pin her namesake's shoulders to the floor while I held her wrists down. Sympathy carved a frown into Angelica's reddening face as Anna struggled.
She said she doesn't know you.
And in that devastating moment, I finally faced the reality that my beautiful daughter was lost. To me, to herself, to time itself. The loss had been a steady one, like a tree losing its fall foliage one fiery leaf at a time, so that you didn't notice the falling away until the tree was nearly and suddenly bare. When the fight bled out of Anna and her muscles went lax, she curled against my sister's knees and sobbed.
"He's an imposter, Aunt Angelica,"
Anna wailed between hitching breaths.
"If he goes away, the real Philip can come home."
"If who goes away?" Angelica asked, rubbing my daughter's back.
"Little Phil,"
Anna cried.
"He stole my brother's name and his place in our family, and the real Philip wants to come home to us."
I cupped my hand to my mouth, believing it entirely possible that I might be ill. I hadn't ever thought Anna could be a danger to the other children. I'd even relied upon her to look after them. But now my beautiful, talented daughter had tried to suffocate her youngest brother, to bring back her oldest. Dear God, no more. It was true that I'd had a double share of good fortune and blessings in my life. But had that happiness not yet been repaid many times over in grief? When I recounted all the losses, my sister, my son, my mother, my husband, my father, I wanted to scream at God that my ledger must now be balanced. Seeing me near to breaking, Angelica nodded to the door.
"Go, take the little ones."
Dragging myself off the floor, I was a disheveled wreck, bruised, tendrils of hair askew, a tear in my sleeve. I righted myself and ushered little Phil and Lisbeth into the hall, grateful beyond measure that the rest of the boys were at school.
"Are you hurt?"
I asked my little boy.
"No, Mama,"
he said, being brave despite his quivering lower lip. I pulled him into my arms and held him tight against me in gratitude, then reached for Lisbeth and cuddled her, too. "This can't go on," Angelica said later. After she'd finally calmed Anna, who'd fallen into a troubled sleep, my sister had locked the door to her room. But when she put the door key beside me where I stood, staring out at a bleak winter world, I shuddered, hearing my husband's voice.
"They will lock her away."
Angelica's hand rested upon my shoulder.
"You've done all you could for as long as you could, Eliza. My niece needs more care than any one person is capable of giving."
But years of charitable visits to hospitals and almshouses had left me with a horrifying knowledge of the conditions.
"I cannot tolerate the thought of Anna."
I shook my head and searched for another answer, another way. What kind of mother cast out her own daughter?
"They locked my mother up. I will never let it happen to Anna."
"I know what you're thinking,"
my sister said, taking my hand. But I didn't think she did. Alexander's voice didn't echo for her as it did now for me.
But you aren't here, Alexander, I thought. You aren't here to take care of her or any of us. You aren't here or anywhere I can find you.
Angelica cleared her throat.
Private asylums can provide the appropriate environment.
She'll be offered exercise, work, education, religious instruction.
I nodded,
having read the work of Dr. Rush and others emphasizing humane treatment to those with disordered minds instead of restraint, exorcism, and punishment.
How had it come to this?
With a shiver, I admitted, she could have killed little Phil today.
Yes,
and she might succeed next time.
Next time.
As much as I wanted to deny it, I knew there would be a next time.
But she wasn't aware. She didn't know. It's not her fault.
I managed, a knot in my throat.
She was always such a sweet girl before. You remember, don't you? She was...
I remember, Angelica said.
And of course it's not her fault.
It's not yours either. Even if you kept watch over her every moment of every day, you couldn't make her better. And your other children would suffer from your inattention. To say nothing of the burden on young Alex. My eldest surviving son had taken up the practice of law to help support the family and felt the burden keenly. To add another worry upon his still slender shoulders. You must make the only choice a loving mother can, my sister concluded. I swallowed hard.
How do I...
Angelica pulled me into her embrace before I could sob.
Let me make the arrangements.
And she did. It was snowing when the doctor arrived a few mornings later to take my daughter to what Angelica assured me was a reputable private asylum about 10 miles away, with bucolic views of forests, fields, and the East River. My sister had even arranged for Anna to have a new piano there, for Anna still played, singing the same songs, and only the songs she'd sung before Philip died. To my surprise, Anna was amenable to going, assuming the doctor was a coachman meant to take her to visit her grandfather, as she'd done so many times before. I gathered my coat to join them, but the doctor held up his hand.
Madam, we find it less disturbing to the patients to avoid upsetting parting scenes with the family.
I froze at the threshold and gazed out at the carriage where my daughter already waited.
Oh, I said hollowly.
You can visit, he reassured me, when she's settled. Certainly you'll want to visit.
Yes, I said, as soon as possible.
The doctor smiled and doffed his cap. Meanwhile, I looked past him to my beautiful Anna, who would continue to age but never grow old. My eyes saw her alive, but my heart felt like I was losing another child. I was losing another child, and heartbroken against relentless losses, I just stood there, numb against the cold, watching until I could no longer see my daughter's retreating carriage. March, 1805, New York City. They wept for Aaron Burr. The story made all the papers. Far from shunning a man indicted for murder in 2 states, Jefferson invited Burr to dine at the president's mansion. But then, perhaps sensing that Burr could be of no further use to him in his 2nd term, Jefferson replaced him as vice president. Thus, in Burr's farewell address on the floor of the Senate chamber, he stood in front of God and country and dared to speak of law and order and liberty, and the need of the Senate to protect the Constitution from the silent arts of corruption and the sacrilegious hands of the demagogue. And on their feet and applauding, the members of that body wept for the man who murdered my husband. Of course, afterward, Burr suffered almost instantaneous political exile. I have ever thought that was too kind a fate by far. But he was now on the run, and that would have to satisfy me. for I had more pressing matters to attend, namely, my conscience. Since giving over my eldest daughter to a doctor's care, I couldn't shake the guilt, which was why, in what I think now was partly a desperate act of penance for having sent Anna away, I turned my attention back to the Society for the Protection of Poor Widows with Small Children. Still working with Widow Graham, her daughter, Mrs. Joanna Bethune, and several other pious ladies, I rededicated myself to raising funds, reviewing eligibility requirements, and visiting the homes of candidates for our assistance to determine whether they met the criteria, which sometimes meant taking the ferry across the East River to Blackwell's Island, location of one of the city's most notorious almshouses. From the outside, the almshouse was a series of sagging, decrepit, gray blocks surrounded by mud, filth, and excrement. Despite its location on an island, the air was stagnant and thick, unhealthful and miasmic. Inside was worse. The halls reeked of every manner of bodily function, and the few little ones with energy enough to spy on me around door frames were so malnourished as to be frightening in their appearance. "Pardon me," I said to the clerk, sitting with boots propped upon the desk and a hat resting over his eyes. Lazily, he moved the hat, and his dark gaze caught up to the basket of victuals I carried. A sneer settled upon his bearded face.
"God save me from do-gooders," he murmured.
I paid him no mind. "I'm here to see Widow Donahue." He made no move to render assistance, but I was not easily put off. "Would you be so kind as to let her know that Mrs. General Hamilton is here to see her?" Suddenly, the man righted his chair and stood.
"Mrs. General Hamilton,"
he nodded.
"Yes, ma'am, right away. And please use the administrator's office. He's out just now."
"Thank you, good sir," I smiled, for it was easier to forgive the man's rudeness when his respect for my husband was so apparent. The Hamilton name still held power in New York, and I wasn't afraid to use it in the service of protecting children, mine and those of the city Alexander helped build.
"Mrs. Hamilton,"
came a woman's voice from the doorway, a babe on her hip, and a wisp of a girl clinging to her dirty, threadbare skirts. For a moment, I saw not the orphaned girls, but my own little Phil and Lisbeth, who were not much older, and I yearned to set them all at ease.
"Thank you for meeting with me. Please sit."
Smiling, I opened my basket and laid out a few pastries I'd baked. Hunger etched the faces of the precious little girls. I gave them a nod and watched in satisfaction as they ate their fill. "Now, Mrs. Donahue, if we might begin our interview, may I ask how old you are?"
20,
she answered.
20. Just Anna's age.
Anna could have been married. Anna could have had children of her own. It didn't take long to determine that Mrs. Donahue met the society's criteria. She had a home, such as it was. She was mother of children under the age of 10. She had no income, didn't beg or sell liquor, and appeared to be of good moral character. The assistance we could offer would help in her daily struggle for survival, exposed to the contaminating influence of the impious, immoral, indolent, and criminal. And she was grateful. But still she asked,
What will happen to my children, Mrs. Hamilton, if I should die?"
I had no good answer. Our charity was founded to benefit widows. Nothing in our charter allowed for us to help orphans. And it seemed to me quite an oversight. Upon taking my leave of the almshouse, I glanced at the clerk's open ledger, listing children that had been admitted to this place, and copied it into my notebook. Bridget Fogarty, age 2 weeks, died of congestion of the brain. Catherine Connor, age 6 months, died of marasmus. Albert Smith, age 3 weeks, died of diarrhea. Charles May, age 6 weeks, died of syphilis. On and on it went. Children dead of overcrowding and disease and sheer misery. Were my own children so different from these little lost souls? What should happen to them if I should fall ill and die? Though Angelica promised she'd always care for my children as if they were her own, and I believed her, I feared for my little ones to be left alone in this world to fend for themselves, as their father had been forced to do. No child should have to suffer what he did. Certainly not his own children. Left to the influence of unscrupulous persons, left with scars and taint, and viewing themselves as having to claw up from a pit of mud. No one, not my children or anyone's children, ought to suffer this. Not in a country like ours with so many resources. In a civilized world, there should be some system to prevent it. And though I'd never had my husband's genius for organizing military, financial, and political matters, I had ambitions for my own civic creations. Which was why, at the Society's annual meeting the following spring, I insisted, "We must do more." I'd come to value my friendship with the serious-minded and zealously devout Mrs. Bethune. So I was delighted when she agreed. What these children need is shelter, a refuge, an asylum of their own. "I've long believed it," Widow Graham said, wearing a plain black frock and white cap upon her thinning gray hair. "A place where they can receive religious instruction, moral example, and be trained up to be useful and productive." As second directress of the society, I sat at the head of the table next to our venerable founder and her daughter. Placing my hand upon the table as if a Bible sat thereon, I added my voice to the cause. So the Orphan Asylum Society was born. Because some life must grow up from amongst all this death and sacrifice. And I was done with losing things. Chapter 38. August 1807. New York City.
"Wonderful work you ladies are doing," Pendleton said as I gave him and a small group of benefactors a tour of the new orphanage. "Just wonderful work. You must be quite proud of what you've accomplished." "It's God's work indeed," Reverend Mason added.
I beamed at their praise, for I was proud. We'd purchased a 2-story frame house on Raisin Street in Greenwich Village for the children, and even though it had 16 beds, we'd been flooded with applications in heartbreaking numbers, over 200 in all. In every story, in every name, I saw Alexander. We would need another facility to help them all. It wasn't enough, but it was progress. And as I showed the group one of the bedrooms with its small beds all in a neat row, I said, "It's a start." But there was a cause more dear to my heart that I was even more eager to see underway. 3 years had passed since my husband's death, and not a word of his biography had yet been written. Partly due to my difficulty finding someone to write it, and partly due to the disorder in which my husband's papers were left. At least this was the excuse given by Pendleton, who still held back certain documents from me, claiming they had to do with ongoing legal matters. And now, whenever I found myself in the presence of the thin-lipped, barrel-chested jurist who'd been my husband's law partner, I was plagued by conflicting emotions. Pendleton had stood by his testimony that my husband threw away his fire. Pendleton had also loaned us money and taught my newly graduated son James the practice of law. I was certainly grateful to him. But I felt resentment, too, for I could never see the man without wondering, "You were his second, his law partner, and his friend. Why didn't you stop him from taking part in a duel?" It wasn't a fair question. Perhaps nothing but a bullet could have stopped Alexander Hamilton. But he ought to be remembered,
which was the point I hoped to make when I gifted Pendleton with a ring I'd made with a clipping of Alexander's hair, set beneath glass. He still wore it in friendship, something I admired as everyone offered their congratulations at the end of the tour. I stopped Reverend Mason and Pendleton before they too departed, and took the opportunity to remind them, every day, every hour, every moment that passes without my dear Hamilton's story being told is another memory lost to history. Pendleton gave a regretful smile, while pretending not to glance impatiently at his gold pocket watch. Perhaps there is an advantage in waiting. For the Federalists shall soon sweep back into office. We are the party of Washington, and our success shall make the people remember that. I bit my tongue. For if the Federalists were the party of Washington, they were even more the party of Hamilton. But it would do my cause here today no good to push the matter. Thankfully, the Reverend did it for me.
The General's biography will take some years to prepare, and not a moment ought to be wasted.
He smiled at the younger man,
which is why I've agreed to write it, with Mrs. Hamilton's permission and encouragement.
Isn't that wonderful? I asked, smiling at the revelation of my achievement. I'd finally secured a scholar to write Hamilton's biography. He was not only a man of letters, but an incorruptible man of God. When I made requests to borrow or look at letters my husband sent other men in government, my requests were often ignored. But they were unlikely to ignore a man of the cloth. And that suspicion was borne out when Pendleton cleared his throat and said,
"Indeed. Well, you're welcome to anything at the office, Reverend."
"The only impediment now is resources," I said, first meeting Madison's eager gaze, then Pendleton's recalcitrant one. "For there will be expenses. We might have to travel. To Mount Vernon, certainly, to transcribe letters Alexander once sent to Washington. To get the money, I could sell off some of the land Papa left to me. But this country owed a great debt to my husband that hadn't been paid. Other war widows received a pension, but I had none. In a fit of high-mindedness, Alexander had renounced the benefits he was due as an officer in the war. Now that the Republicans insisted upon destroying the country's commerce with their idiotic trade embargo, breaking up my husband's national bank and emptying the treasury, they at least ought to be made to pay for it. But I couldn't lobby for the pension while Jefferson was still president. I was told that, upon a pedestal in the entryway of Monticello, Jefferson kept a bust of my husband across from a bust of himself, and quipped to guests that he and my husband were opposed in death as in life. That icy hypocrite wouldn't just thwart me but laugh in my face as he did it. In a very genteel southern fashion, I'm sure, just as he was likely doing to Aaron Burr, whose downfall that summer became something of a spectacle in which I must admit to taking pleasure. For Burr had finally been arrested, though not, as one might have imagined, for the murder of my husband. Instead, Burr had been apprehended in Alabama on charges of plotting to annex, possibly by military force, Spanish territory in Louisiana and Mexico to establish an independent republic. Treason. I didn't find it difficult to believe that, denied acceptance, power, and influence in our country, Burr had resolved to create a new one. Just as Alexander warned, Burr was willing to dismantle the Union for which we'd all sacrificed, and I hoped to see him hang for it. It had taken years to see some manner of justice brought to bear upon Aaron Burr. It might take years for Mason to complete my husband's biography, or for me to ever have the opportunity to collect his pension. But I knew how to use patience as a political weapon, and I could bide my time. March, 1810, Baltimore, Maryland.
"Are you certain you know what you're about?"
McHenry asked, seated in the closed coach beside me as it jerked and jostled along the country roads. Mac had long since retired from politics to his Maryland estate, which he named Fayetteville, after our old French friend. Mac had also long since gone from stout to portly, and his health was not good. He devoted his time entirely to domestic pursuits, his wife, their delightful children, and writing a novel. Or at least he had been thus engaged until the former president, John Adams, published a series of letters in the paper purporting to tell the real history of his administration, the failure of which he laid squarely at the doorstep of my dear Hamilton, with McHenry in a conspiring role. That put Mac in a fighting mood, so much so that he agreed to accompany me and my eldest son, Alex, to the nation's capital, where I intended to petition my government for redress. Now that I had a biographer, I wanted my husband's pension. Finally, there would be recognition for Alexander's accomplishments. Still, Mac couldn't seem to stop warning me against it. Not even after Alex, serving as our driver, had taken the reins and got us underway. Inside the carriage, I told Mac, "Washington City can't be that frightening a place." He snorted.
"Last I spent time there, it was a swampy, malarious wilderness.
And you'll find a friendly face even more rare than an honest man." "But Jefferson is gone," I said, because that was the important thing. After 8 years as Commander-in-Chief, our third president bowed to the tradition set by George Washington and withdrew to his mountaintop plantation of Monticello. Hopefully for good. But McHenry wasn't nearly as relieved.
"You remember that the Federalists still lost the election."
My husband's party did more than lose. We'd been obliterated. Still, I waved his concern away. "Nevertheless, Jefferson is gone and the new president is a different man."
"You think so? These Virginians are all the same."
"Washington was a Virginian," I reminded him. "Besides, I know James Madison." Of course, I'd also known Benedict Arnold, Aaron Burr, Thomas Jefferson, and James Monroe. And at some point, I'd believed the best of each of them. There was no reason to believe Madison was different. It was more of a feeling, some instinct that I derived from the fact that Madison had, after all these years, remained publicly coy on the authorship of the individual Federalist essays, tentatively honoring the pledge we'd made decades before. Then, too, there was the letter. I'd found it in one of the locked cupboards of my husband's desk at the Grange. The last letter Madison ever wrote to him, 3 years before Alexander died. Short and businesslike, about some matter of state, Madison had closed the letter with this line, "I have the honor to remain, sir, your obedient servant." That was not the standard closing. The word "remain" leaped out to me, as if Madison had meant it in wistful recollection of friendship lost. Alexander must have thought so, too, for him to have kept it locked away, separate from his other papers. It wasn't much to cling to, I admit, but it gave me hope. Mac was decidedly less sanguine.
"I don't think you know what you're up against, Mrs. Hamilton."
"I doubt any of us did when we joined the revolution," I countered, for sometimes it seemed as if it was one long war we were still fighting, and I couldn't help but remember when we were young and hopeful members of General Washington's military family. Alexander Hamilton, John Laurens, Tench Tillman, Mrs. Washington. All of them gone now. Only a few of us still surviving. And I wondered if Mac was thinking of them too, because he grew wistful, adjusting himself in his seat with the use of his cane.
"I know my pangs must be a wee drop in the ocean of your tears, but to this day, whenever the post comes, I somehow always think I'll find a letter from Hamilton."
I smiled softly, as it consoled me to hear it somehow. Alas, we must content ourselves with the letters he sent in life.
and I feel as if it has become the whole of my existence to hunt them down.
It must be wearying, Max said,
and I didn't think he meant only the hunt for Alexander's papers. Like my husband, James McHenry had dedicated the better part of his life to public service.